Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now a Major League Baseball player who takes the field to the theme from Game of Thrones. At least he did when he was winning the Cy Young Award with the Mets in 2012. I don't know what he does in Toronto, but he is R.A. Dickey, and he's in town because his current team, the Toronto Blue Jays, plays the Yankees in the Bronx tonight. And R.A. Dickey, one of baseball's writers and readers, has a new book, his second children's book. This one is called Knuckleball Ned, with illustrations by Tim Bowers, about a kid baseball who gets bullied for being a little different, for being a knuckleball, of course. R.A. Dickey, it's a thrill. Big fan. Welcome to WNYC.
I appreciate being here. Thank you very much.
And usually we don't think of Major League Baseball players as people who write children's books. How'd you get into this?
Well, you know, I've always loved writing. You know, there's something very permanent about the written word to me. And as a child, some of my best memories are my parents reading to me. And after wherever I wound up, the memoir I wrote, I had an idea for a children's book that I pitched to Penguin. And they embraced it and helped me develop it and create it. And here we are.
Knuckleball Ned is different from the other balls because he wobbles and he gets bullied for being different by the dastardly Foul Ball Gang. Is this a book about embracing difference?
Yeah, I think it's about embracing difference. It's also about celebrating what makes us unique. You know, when I wrote the book, it didn't start necessarily as an anti-bullying book. I mean, that's what it might have become, but it's much more about being able to identify what we're passionate about and what makes us unique and being able to really rejoice in that.
And it comes through. And I saw the New Yorker article from 2012 in which you're discussing your first draft of this book with your editor, and she's not sure that four-year-olds would get what bullying is, so maybe it should be for older kids. How did that process continue after that?
Well, I think it's like anything. You know, I was hungry to learn about the process of writing a children's book. You know, admittedly, I had zero experience. Now, I love writing. But writing a children's book is much more difficult than one might think. And so I needed some help, and she really helped kind of steer me in the right directions. And I think once we moved from it being, you know, something about bullying and more that being in the background, and it'd be much more about being able to embrace who we are and not being ashamed of who we are, I think that's where it went for me.
Because each of the kid baseballs in this class has their own special talent. You have Connie Curveball and Fiona Fastball and Fletcher Fastball. Are they brother and sister?
No, they're just friends. They're just friends. But, you know, my editor, you know, was very specific in the fact that, you know, kids really relate to good characters. And so having balls be these characters was a perfect fit.
Balls with arms and legs.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, Knuckleball Ned's wobbling saves the day. And that was on a list of your editor's rules in the New Yorker article. The kid always saves the day. Did you have it that way originally?
Yeah, originally that was going to be the plan all along. I just didn't know how I was going to get there. And, you know, Knuckleball Ned is able to do some things that other of the balls can't do, and it enables him to save the day in a way that only he could.
What age did this book turn out to be for, would you say?
I would say anywhere from ages 4 to 8, really. The themes are such that I think small kids can relate to it, and they learn vocabulary as well as life lessons, and the older kids can really you know, get the humor of it and such.
And to be read by a grown-up to the younger ages. And I'd say by the time you're 8, a lot of 8-year-olds could read this book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And you are a reader, baseball's favorite bookworm, as the press release for the book calls you. And it says you read constantly in the bullpen and the clubhouse. Do you really read during games?
Well, not necessarily during games, but in the bullpen, I'll get to the field early and have finished my work and might take a half hour to get out to a solitary place with a book and get into somebody else's world, sure.
Not during during the game. So are you required to pay constant attention to the games, to study all those batters?
Yeah, it's important for me to know a hitter's weaknesses. And so the only way to do that is really to be observant, whether it's on film or live from the dugout. I'm constantly paying attention to, you know, who swings at the first pitch repeatedly, who likes to run the bases, who likes to bunt. Things like that really help equip me to be the best I can be when it's my turn to get out there.
R.A. Dickey with us, his new book, Knuckleball Ned, for ages 4 to 8, as he just said. What are you reading these days? Anything you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm reading a book of short stories by Murakami, which I really have enjoyed. And then I like to always reread a classic. Part of my training as an English major, I really had an affinity for classics. So I'm reading Tale of Two Cities by Dickens again. So
how many times is that for you?
It's probably my fourth or fifth time.
So Mayor de Blasio would be happy with this. Do you read political books? You know, this is a pretty news-based show. So
yeah.
Do you read any current nonfiction or current events?
Well, right at, presently, I am not. But, you know, I read a book, and forgive me if I mispronounce the title, but I think it's The World is Flat.
Thomas Friedman.
Yeah, by Friedman, which I really enjoyed. And, you know, I like to read books that I can – have conversations with my peers about. That one was kind of a tough one, but others I can really dialogue with my friends about.
How about Tale of Two Cities? You talk about that with your outfielders in the clubhouse?
Well, there's some guys that really like to read. You'd be surprised. I think we get a bad stereotype kind of thrown down on us that we only like to play card games and baseball and video games. But there's a contingency around the league that really enjoy the written
work. You know who else was another Mets pitcher into some culture? Tom Seaver. He was on the show, and he told the story of when he was a player on the road, he would always go to the art museums in the away game cities. Did you know that about Tom?
I did not. That's something that I enjoy to do, too. That's interesting. Ron Darling, who is one of the guys who broadcasts for the Mets, is also a guy who I really appreciate his taste for culture as well.
A Yalie. You talk literature with your Yalie
broadcaster? Yeah, we did actually have a couple of conversations about it. Yeah.
And I once got a tour of the Yankee Stadium press level, and their late stadium announcer, Bob Shepard, mm-hmm. was famous for constantly reading between batters. And I saw him do it, and he had a book there in his booth. I didn't get to see what it was, but he would only occasionally miss announcing a batter because he was too engrossed, only occasionally. I don't know if you ever knew that or even met or discussed reading with Bob Shepard.
No, but it makes me like him more, that's for sure.
And other ball players, they don't make fun of your reading? They don't call you a bookworm or egghead or anything?
No. You know, I think some of that now is that we kind of live in a progressive culture. I think back, you know, when I was younger, if I was a rookie and I whipped out a book in the clubhouse, somebody might have said something. But now, you know, I feel like people really accept who you are. And people are also that, you know, that don't read as much can be somewhat intimidated by someone that might have an education about literature.
You said you go to the museum sometimes on the road like Tom Seaver did. Fans think it's so glamorous to be a pro ball player, and in many ways it is. But you're in a different city every 3 days. You're working the night shift usually. How would you describe the lifestyle?
Well, I would describe it as pretty dysfunctional, to be honest. You know, I'm married and have 4 kids, and we play 162 games in 183 days, and half those games are on the road. So right off the bat, I'm away from home almost a third of the year, which is really difficult. But as far as like when you're in the cities, you know, it's a lot of work. It really is. Now, there are a lot of perks that come with being a professional baseball player, and I don't want anybody to hear me complaining about it. But at the same time, it also has its challenges.
They say the athletes who actually make it to the pro level are not just really good at what they do. They tend to be fiercely competitive and driven to win, win, win. And you see it in all aspects of their life. Do you think that's true in general?
I do. I think that there is a level of extreme competitiveness that every Major League Baseball player has. Probably every athlete that plays at the highest level has. Now, being able to set that down when the game is over and go be a normal dad or go be a normal husband is a real challenge. And I would say the guys that endure long careers have, I'm not going to say mastered, but have been able to practice that attribute of being able to leave it at the field, because it can really haunt you if you let it.
Is that hard for you? Because people are hearing you today. Some people who are not baseball fans are hearing you today for the first time and thinking, gee, what an intellectual, introspective guy. And yet you want to go out there and hammer the other team, and you have a part of you that just needs to win and be on top. Would you put it that way?
Well, you know, I don't know if I would put it so barbaric. You know, I think I have a job to do, and that's to perform my best with the tools I've been given. And at the end of the day, sometimes it's good enough and sometimes it's not. But, you know, my hope every day when I take the mound is that I'm going to win the ball game. And I try to do everything I can to do that. Now, I wouldn't say that, you know, I'm a win at all costs, you know, scuff the baseball, you know, run over players on the field kind of guy. But at the same time, I think when I have a ball in my hand, people there needs to be a healthy fear there.
Yeah. I saw the movie about you and some other knuckleball pitchers called Knuckleball. And your wife and four kids come up in that pretty prominently. You were in the minors making minor league money for years, traveling on the buses instead of the airplanes, charter planes. And you kept at it past the age when most players give it up if they didn't get to the major leagues by then. Being such a family guy and the sacrifices you were having to make, what kept you going for it?
You know, in a word, probably hope. Hope, and I'm not a self-made man by any stretch of the imagination. I know I've had a lot of people who have poured into me in a very selfless way to enable me to chase the dream of being a Major League Baseball player, my wife being one of them. I'll never forget in 2006, I was about to give it up and go do something else, and she didn't want me to have a singular regret and said, you know,
She backed you all the way.
Yeah, she backed me all the way, and it was a very transforming moment for me because I was at a stage in my life and in my marriage where I needed to make some changes, and she was supporting me in that, but also said, I want you to keep chasing your dream.
Ari Dickey with us for another few minutes. His new book, children's book, is called Knuckleball Ned. There's a lot of talk in sports media this year about so many young pitchers getting arm injuries, and the speculation is that they just throw too many innings these days as kids, literally as kids, playing travel ball and multiple seasons per year and everything. Do you have an opinion about that?
I do. You know, I think really as a species, we've evolved athletically in a way that guys are throwing a lot faster than they ever have before in greater numbers. So they're generating higher arm speeds collectively. And whenever you have more of something, you're going to have more injuries because of it, because of the volume of people. When I came out in high school, I think there were probably three or four guys that threw above 95 miles an hour. And now you have literally hundreds of guys who throw close to 100 miles an hour in high school. So we're evolving. Maybe it's because the strength programs that are implemented so early in the lives of these kids. Maybe it's just because as a species we're getting stronger and stronger. Who knows? But the body isn't made for that overhand motion, particularly when you're throwing 100 miles an hour over and over over the course of 100 pitches in a game. And so I would attribute a lot of it to that.
That's why knuckleball pitchers can last into your 40s, right?
Yeah, that helps.
It's a softer thing.
Yeah.
Do you need to change from a stereotypical athlete's mindset? Again, I'm going to trade in a, you know, stereotype of athletes. But it's so much less about power, more about restraint, because you have to throw the knuckleball. And I know yours is relatively hard, but pretty soft. So is it not only a physical skill, but a new relationship with what it means to be competitive?
Yeah, that's a good insight. You know, I think, you know, just a quick education, you know, a conventional pitcher is always trying to impart spin on the baseball in different ways to make it break certain ways. Well, a knuckleball pitcher is trying to remove spin completely, and that takes a very specific mechanic. And it's not one that you can operate at 100% capacity all the time. I'm much better when I'm at about 70% capacity, which is a lot less effort than a conventional pitcher. Thusly, I'm able to throw a little bit longer as far as the endurance of my career. And also, I can rebound a lot quicker.
Why would a ball without spin be harder to hit?
Well, because the movement is so unpredictable. You know, hitters are incredible athletes as far as hand-eye coordination goes. And if they can predict the flight of the ball, they can put the barrel on it.
So without spin, it bounces into air currents?
Yes, it uses wind resistance to be able to move around very erratically.
Is a windy day good or bad for a knuckleball pitcher?
Wind in my face is pretty good. Wind at my back is might be a tough day.
Interesting. And I see that with your love of literature, you name your bats after famous swords in literature. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. I thought it was a fun way to stay interested, you know.
Like what?
Well, in the National League, you're hitting. Not so much in the American League, unless you're playing interleague play. But, you know, I had Orcrist, the Goblin Cleaver, and recently I got a new bat named the Oath Keeper from the Game of Thrones.
All right. Did you see the finale?
Of course.
What'd you think?
I thought it was great. And it makes me so sad that I have to wait till next baseball season to start seeing more of them.
Do you still use the Game of Thrones theme? Did I get that right at the beginning?
You did
use that as a Met, right?
Absolutely, and I use it currently as a Blue Jay.
Still use it as a Blue Jay. We've just got 30 seconds left. I don't know. I read you got injured in your last start. You're going to be able to pitch in this Yankee series?
Well, my day is on Friday against the Cincinnati Reds, so unfortunately I'll miss the Yankees. And I'll be pitching Friday night, but I don't expect to miss a start.
Miss New York?
I do. There's a lot of things about this city that I really love.
Well, a lot of Met fans were very unhappy to see you go.
Oh, thank you.
And a lot of Met fans and others were very happy to hear you here today. R.A. Dickey, his new children's book for ages 4 to 8, is called Knuckleball Ned. Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
They call him Ragtime Willie. We're gonna soothe away the rest of our years. We're gonna put away all of our tears. That big rocking chair won't go nowhere. Slow down, Willie boy.
All right, it's a family meeting on retirement on the Brian Lehrer Show today. And we move now to retirement geography. You heard that last caller on the way to Sarasota. Someone else wanted to go to Florida. Other people can't stand it. Did you move in retirement, or would you want to move in retirement if you're not there yet? Or were you forced to move in retirement? More oral histories. Tell us your retirement geography stories. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Did you move in retirement? If you're younger and looking down the road, eventually, would you want to move in retirement? Or were you forced to move in retirement for economic reasons? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Retirement geography, our next topic in our family meeting on retirement. And there are lots of wrinkles to this we can explore to figure out who we are as individuals and to help other listeners. Where do you want to retire? In your old Virginia rocking chair, like the band there in that piece we just heard, or just retire to your stoop on Avenue V? How about retiring to your RV to travel the campgrounds of America? Retirement geography, 212-433-WNYC. Let's get two callers on together to start this off. We have Sarah in Highland Lakes in New Jersey, and we have Leonard in Manhattan. I think they may have reasons for an interesting conversation. Sarah, you're on WNYC. Hi. And can we add Leonard on line 3 at the same time? Let's see if we can put Leonard up and get these guys talking to each other. Leonard, you there?
Here.
All right, Leonard. Now, hang on just a second, because Sarah, what are you thinking about? How old are you, and what are you thinking here?
Well, I'm 38 years old.
38.
I grew up in Chicago and Manhattan, inner city, and now I live in Highland Lakes in a beautiful lake community on the side of a mountain in the woods with the bears. And it's gorgeous, and I love it. I have two little girls. It's fabulous. But there's no way I'm shoveling 5 feet of snow when I'm 65.
So you would want to live in a city is what you're saying.
Oh, definitely. As soon as I can convince my husband, I figure I have about 25 more years to convince him we're moving to a city. There's no public transportation by me. If you live in the city or work in New York City, there's public transportation. But if not, you're kind of out of luck. And I grew up where my dad's 72. He doesn't drive, but he doesn't need to. He takes the train, he takes the bus, he can hop a cab in Chicago, that is, or Manhattan. And that's the kind of retirement I'm looking for, not driving an hour to the closest hospital.
So, Leonard, you are retired in Manhattan, is that right?
Yes, I am. And I don't know that I'm so diametrically opposed to what Sarah was just talking about. But I have a very comfortable situation. I live in the West Village. I have a rent-regulated apartment, and I have a sufficient income. I have a pension and Social Security. But I do feel alienated by the ethos of the community. I feel constantly on edge because there's so much noise around me. You know, the city is so restive. There's all this construction going on all the time. Traffic outside my window is noisy.
So maybe you should switch homes with Sarah someday.
No, I don't want to live. I don't want to be devoid of some of the stimulation of being. Right. In a civilized city.
You don't want to live near the lake. Near the lake with the bears. That's not the thing.
Well, I don't want to be chased by a bear. I mean, I just bought new running shoes, but they're not really not for running. So, I think sort of a more modest city, if that exists, maybe a college town. And I've lived in New York all my life. I'm going to be 70 in a couple of weeks. And I was saying to the screener that, you know, there's all this vaunted attention to the availability of culture in New York. Well, a lot of the time, you really have to be rich to take advantage of the culture in New York. Culture in New York is so expensive. I was up at MoMA yesterday, and a cup of coffee was $4.50.
Right.
And I have an income, and I could do it once in a while, but you always feel that you know, there are people around who are a lot richer, spending all this money, and the things you want to see, if you want to go to the top-level cultural events at the opera or the ballet or Philharmonic,
right.
They're really expensive.
The top-level stuff. So, Sarah, is he talking you out of this plan?
No, not at all. I plan on being... See, that sounds fabulous. I miss it. I plan on being in either Chicago or Nashville. Because that's true. Manhattan is very expensive. We moved out of Manhattan when I was 9. But Chicago is a much more affordable city. You can get around. You have access. You have lots of culture. And it's also much more spread out. I think there's no way I could ever afford to retire in Manhattan. I'm not wealthy, yeah. Independently wealthy. But Nashville, my husband and I have been eyeballing actually Nashville for about 5 years now.
That's a pretty different lifestyle from Chicago, right?
It is. Nashville has a nice mix. It has the music scene. It's much more diverse, and it's a little slow, a little laid back.
Yep.
But definitely, I know I'm not going to be as beautiful as Highland Lakes is. As I get older, I see it's coming there for the summers, because the summers by me are just amazing.
38 and already shopping cities for retirement. Sarah in Highland Lakes, thank you very much. And Leonard in Manhattan, thank you also very much.
You're welcome.
And let's see, I think Nancy in Montclair. In Montclair and Manhattan, she's labeled here on the board, wants to chime in on this conversation. Nancy, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, Brian. I love that conversation with those other two people. That was fun. I was a Foreign Service officer, a diplomat, and before that I was married to one. So I spent most of my life living in cities around the world, and I retired in 1998 to Washington, D.C., which was sort of home base. I am 80, going on 81, actually. And my son convinced me to move to Montclair because it's such a lovely place. And so I did about 4 years ago. And although it is lovely, I felt like everybody there was married or had children or were in couples or whatever. And I was this lone elderly lady sort of relegated to the company of other elderly ladies. And so I had retired and started doing some acting in D.C. and, you know, got some work and eventually got more and more. So I thought, well, I'll try to do something in New York. So I made a little bit of money, and I decided to get an apartment on the Upper East Side in New York, not far from the Reservoir, where I get to walk around it every day.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned the bus system. I get tremendous exercise on the subway stairs. I've joined two museums. I go to theaters constantly and explore all kinds of places. When I go on auditions, I get to go to a different part of the city, you know, like all the time. And so I really love it.
Do you have any tips? Your line is breaking up, and I'm going to have to go in a minute. But do you have any tips for Leonard on how to go to top-level culture and get senior discounts and stuff?
I think he ought to move out of where he's living. It's too noisy. Come to the Upper East Side. It's quiet and not trendy at all. And it's great fun. And if he's in good shape, I don't see why he doesn't want to get that exercise.
Nancy,
get away from the noise.
Thank you so much. Good luck. And
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I'm going next to, let me go to Maria in Manhattan. Maria, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Well, I just want to say a little bit about my story. I came from Colombia 47 years ago. I came to work as a domestic. I put myself through college, graduate and undergraduate, and I was able to buy my apartment. I have it paid up. I just retired last year, November 6th, and my plans are to stay in the city for the summer months and go to Colombia in the winter months. I find that New York City, with all the cultural things that we have here, where I can avail myself for rush tickets, for free concerts, for walks in the park. I live on Central Park South. I find that I'm enjoying life, and all the years of overtime or long work hours, I owe it to myself to be able to have some other type of life that I never had.
So it's a difficult decision for you whether to
Absolutely
stay here
not.
Or go back to Colombia?
No, because over there, the contracts is different. The green and the mountains and the ocean is also something that is very beautiful for the mind, for the body, for the spirit. And
but they're so different. If you're getting rush tickets and you're going to this thing and that thing, compared to sitting back and looking at the beautiful greenery, I'm not saying one is better or the other is better, but they're so different.
Well, yeah, I know, because I had been going over there for vacations. But you can also enjoy books. I am taking books to read. I have television with all zillions of channels to be mm-hmm. able to see.
And the cost of living is much lower.
Excuse me?
The cost of living is much lower.
So definitely. And for 3 months, 4 months, isn't this a different pace? And I think it's something that I owe it to myself to be able to take my life to a different plateau.
Maria, thank you so much for your call. And thanks for your various calls on the geography of retirement. You know, if you watch certain channels on cable, like HGTV or the Travel Channel, you might find yourself watching commercials like this.
Do you dream of living or retiring in a tropical paradise? Are you searching for a better, healthier way of life with less stress and more freedom? Are you looking for a safe investment opportunity in a proven and appreciating market? If you answered yes to any of these questions, it's time you discovered the incredible country of Belize. Belize is a peaceful, safe, English-speaking country with strong banking and asset protection laws. It also has a very low cost of living and is one of the world's last tax havens. Belize is a land of unparalleled natural beauty, a land of pristine rainforests with cascading waterfalls, lush jungle rivers, picture-perfect islands with powdery white sand and crystal blue waters. Best yet, this beautiful little country is only hours from the U.S. and is home to some of the best real estate opportunities in the world. So go to buybelize.com today. That's buybelize.com.
So maybe you've seen that or commercials like it for other countries. So let's ask, what if you want to retire abroad? Here with me now to talk about this and take your calls is Kathleen Petticord, the founder of the Live and Invest Overseas Publishing Group and the author of How to Retire Overseas, Everything You Need to Know to Live Well for Less Abroad. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Why does Belize, in particular, advertise for our retirees so much?
I love that commercial that you just played, and it does a good job of representing what Belize has to offer. Belize and a handful of other countries, in fact, are working very hard now to attract American retirees because they need something that American retirees have, which is disposable income. And so there are a handful of countries, I'd say Belize, Panama, Ecuador, Nicaragua, increasingly Colombia in particular, are trying hard to, in fact, advertise and market to attract American retiree attention.
I'm sure everybody's experience is different, but I have a cousin who did move to Belize. And he left after a few years because where he could afford to live, though it was a gorgeous spot, left him feeling isolated and without many people or much to do, and he moved back to the States. Is that a risk?
It definitely is. And it's, I mean, this idea isn't for everyone. And I always, my recommendation to people who are intrigued by the idea, you know, if your attention is caught by this, start by thinking about really, and this starts to sound quickly touchy-feely, but who you are and what you want. Start there, because exactly what you're describing is not impossible, that you make a move before you've really connected the dots between your priorities, your interests, the lifestyle that you want, what you want out of life. I was listening to callers a few minutes ago comparing, you know, city life versus lakeside living, and that, of course, is the decision you face anywhere you'd go in the world. So in Belize, you could retire to a place on Ambergris Key, for example, a little town on Ambergris Key, where there are a lot of American retirees already living there. And so you'd have a community to connect to. It's one of the biggest expat communities outside the States. Elsewhere in Belize, sure, you'd be very, very isolated and have little company, and that it would definitely not be for everyone.
So listeners, give us a quick call if you're thinking about or planning to retire in another country. Tell us where, tell us why, 212-433-WNYC, whether you're moving or considering moving because you want to get more bang for your buck or because you're looking for an adventure, a lifestyle change, new cultural experiences, more affordability, because you don't want to live in a country that might declare war on Iraq every few years, whatever your reason, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Juan in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Juan.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your story?
Yeah, my story is I am from Spain. Mm-hmm. I lived in Spain, you know, 17 years ago. I went to Australia. I'm from Australia and moved to New York. And I left my country because, you know, just for an adventure. You know, I had a great job in my country, and I love traveling. So I came here 8 years ago. I love this country. I love New York City. I think as an European that I couldn't live in any other a place in the United States, and I'm planning to go back to Spain when I retire, because, you know, I love working in the States. This is a place very good for working, but it's you have to learn how to enjoy life. You know, this is not a place for enjoying life.
I mean, love this idea. New York is a great place to work. America, Spain is a great place to live. By the way, I think I actually hear your Spanish Australian accent. You have one, don't you?
Well, the thing is, when I left Spain, I didn't speak one word in English. You know, all the English I learned was in Australia, in Sydney. I speak French and I speak Portuguese, and now I speak English too. But the thing is, I got something from the Aussies that I understand you. You can catch some of my accent from there. But
absolutely. And then you're going to go back to Spain and you're going to say, I used to live in New York. And you will have done the whole cycle. Juan, thank you. And good luck out there. And here's somebody who has done it. Alex is calling us from Buenos Aires. Right, Alex?
Yeah, it's me. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Alex. So what's your story? Did you live your whole life in the States until you retired?
Yeah, I lived my whole adult life in New York City. I was born here originally in Buenos Aires, but my family moved to the States when I was 12, and I went to work for several companies in New York, and I became unemployed, and I thought, well, the only thing I had of value was my apartment, so I sold it in 2007 and landed here in 2008, and I've been here ever since.
What do you like about it?
Oh, it's just easy living. One expat I met here called it the slacker's paradise. It's very easy to live. You know, it's just very European, very cosmopolitan. It's a lot of free stuff. It's cheap. You can get a lot of return on your dollar. So it's very easy.
Alex, thank you very much. Good luck in Buenos Aires. And Pat in Maplewood has a report from Belize. Right, Pat?
I don't live in Belize. We have friends who have a house there, and they have their only concern, from what I can gather, is that as you get older, you have health care issues, and they I think Belize City has a really good hospital, but they have to actually take a small plane to get there. And I think it's about an hour away. So I think that becomes a consideration.
Pat, thank you very much. And Kathleen Petticord, you can't take your U.S. Medicare and get reimbursed if you're living in a foreign country, correct?
Exactly. Medicare won't cover you outside the states.
And so this is a big consideration when people are deciding whether to live abroad. Is the health care adequate?
It is. I'd say that's one of the top questions to consider when you start focusing on particular countries. You want to look at the healthcare situation. And frankly, unfortunately, that's not one of Belize's strong suits. There's a frankly decent hospital in Belize City. Outside Belize City, the healthcare is even less good. What many expats in Belize do is cross the border into Mexico when they need medical care. When they are, you know, if they have surgery or some critical need like that, they'll hop north into Mexico, which has very, very good medical facilities.
Mark in Manhattan, your retirement home shopping in Panama?
Yeah, I went down with my wife. She's interested in that. Soon I'll. Right now I'm sitting in the van delivering TVs on 39th Street and. Whatever tire. Well, I'm 68 already.
Wow.
Lived all my life on Horatio and Hudson.
Still delivering TVs.
Yeah. So now
so
she's
why,
retired.
Why
goes for rent.
Why Panama?
Well, that's what she looked up. So she's the one on the computer all the time, checking these out things out. We went down, flew to Panama City, then down to David, and rented a car and went up into the cloud forest in a little town called Boquete.
Where would you live if you do it?
Well, we'd have to get a rental. She says that you can rent a house down there for $400 or $500 with one bedroom. And that's a house, not an apartment.
What do you think? Are you tempted?
Well, she wants to go down there. I don't know. You know, I'm a New York City boy.
I'm your therapist now. Talk to me about you.
Well, I like it. It's a beautiful forest. She's into birding. And
what are you
into?
Into
moto, but I was depressed when I went down there and saw the condition the Indios were living in, who work on the famous coffee plantations. They live in little tin shacks with nothing, no facilities. So I went around when we were in the car, going up to the mountains, buying them things, giving them balls, footballs, and things like that. But as I say, we may not have any choice when I retire in a couple of years. It's 70. I'm already 68. And I can't live in New York on Social Security.
And that drives this decision, Kathleen Petticord, for a lot of people. I'm curious about the several callers who we got who were from the countries originally, though they live most of their lives here, and then moved down. Is that what a lot of the marketing is, too, because there's so many immigrants here from everywhere?
That was really interesting to me, too, to hear that in the callers' stories. And no, frankly, I hadn't really ever – I've been writing this stuff for almost 30 years, and I'd never thought of it that way. But it's an insight, I think, into what could be going on. I generally speak to the typical – what I imagine as the typical American retiree and had never thought of the original immigrant connection.
Jack? Driving a taxi. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Brian. Nice to be on your show for the first time.
Nice to have you.
Yeah, I listen to you all the time. Very good show. And
thank you.
As I said, I'm from Haiti, and I'm from the countryside, in the northern part of Haiti. Then I left the country. I was 23. It was the time of the dictator. Of the Duvalier dictatorship.
Yes, glad you got out of that. So do you want to live here when you retire, or do you want to live there, or do you want to split?
Unfortunately, I want to go back home.
Why unfortunately?
Because I came here, I got everything except one thing, a good job. Because when I left my country, I got a degree in education and everything, but I never been able to be, I got problem with English at the beginning. I never been a teacher on a good position, a good job. I end up to be a taxi driver. For me, it's a frustrating job, and I want to quit as soon as possible. So,
Jack, good luck in quitting as soon as possible, having enough money, and then living more cheaply in your country of origin. Thank you. And Kathleen Petticord, thank you very much, founder of the Live and Invest Overseas Publishing Group and the author of How to Retire Overseas, Everything You Need to Know to Live Well for Less Abroad. Such interesting stories from some of you about your process or about your decisions that you've already made. And Kathleen, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
It's our family meeting about retirement on the Brian Lehrer Show. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. You can get a venti anything from Starbucks. Now you might be able to get a college degree if you work there, too. The company has announced a partnership with Arizona State University to reimburse their employees, the company calls them partners, for a college degree. Here is Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz from an interview with WNYC yesterday.
The end goal is to demonstrate that success is best when it's shared. This is not about making more money. This is about attracting and retaining great people. And I think most importantly, providing an opportunity for our employees, a free college education and access to education that unfortunately they're not able to get on their own.
Could this be a model for higher education in the future? Anya Kamenetz is back with us now. This both of the strands of this are kind of right in her wheelhouse, the intersection of her two books, Generation Debt, Why Now is a Terrible Time to Be Young, and DIYU, Edupunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education. She's on the NPR education team. Hi, Anya. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's great to be here.
And there is some fine print on this deal, we should say first. So what's your understanding of how this will work and who it's actually for?
Well, Howard Schultz and ASU President Michael Crow got to know each other over some shared interests and policy concerns, and they really have hatched a plan that's designed to satisfy both of their corporate goals, or I should say institutional goals. And so what that means is, for example, the freshman and sophomore years, if you're coming into school for the first time as a barista, you won't get a full scholarship. It's only a partial scholarship from Starbucks. And then for the junior and senior years, it is a complete reimbursement. But notice that word reimbursement, you do have to put in the money up front, and that does mean taking out student loans. And on top of that, I think, you know, notable is the idea that you have to work at least 20 hours a week at Starbucks, but they also want you to be enrolled full time in order to take advantage of this.
So you have to be doing a kind of barista work study, working 20 hours a week, but be enrolled as a full time online student with Arizona State, correct?
Right. And, you know, 20 hours a week is right on the line. Researchers say that for you know, it's a fine line between working students and students who work. And once you're working 20 hours a week or over, it becomes very difficult to actually remain enrolled full time and graduate on time. But obviously, they're structuring this deal with a big financial incentive to do that, just that.
And how much debt need someone incur in order to do this? Well, the New York Times crunched the numbers, and each credit at Arizona State costs between $480 and $543. Students would need to complete 21 credits before the first reimbursement, so that would come out to between $10,000 and roughly $11,500 up front for a student. So why wouldn't a company just and I know some companies do this with their employees for certain master's degree courses or whatever, but why wouldn't the company just lay out the money for the credit rather than force the students to potentially take over $10,000 of student loans and then reimburse them later?
Well, I mean, we're kind of looking at gift horse in the mouth here, right? Which I think is a totally fair thing to do. But I would say on the company side, they're making sure that they've structured this benefit so that people have to commit and they have to follow through. Otherwise, they're not going to get any of the money. And so cynically, I guess you could say that, you know, it's potentially the case that people might be attracted to work at Starbucks because of this benefit, but then might find it pretty tricky to take advantage of it.
In other words, it's structured so that students are more likely to actually graduate and not just take some courses and then not complete?
Well, yes. And I mean, that idea of attaching consequences to student aid is something that, again, has been floated around in education reform circles for quite a while. And my guess is that Howard Schultz got wind of it and he got excited about this idea. You know, he mentioned, they mentioned in the press releases that out of 135,000 U.S. employees of Starbucks, 70% are either current college students or what they call aspiring college students.
Huh.
And yeah, it's really a big number, and it makes sense when you think about what this demographic is and how many Americans in their 20s and even 30s are carrying around a few college credits but haven't managed to proceed all the way. And so the idea of backloading this benefit, I think, makes a lot of sense from that perspective.
So, listeners, are there any Starbucks baristas among you right now who want to call in and tell us what you think about this announcement? Anybody planning on taking advantage of it or figuring it out and thinking, well, this is intriguing. Let me see if this can work for me. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or anyone else may call, but any current Starbucks baristas who happen to be listening right now, what do you think? And anyone else, could this be a model for the future of paying for a higher education if other companies do similar things? 212-433-9692 for Anya Kamenetz from NPR's education team, also author of Generation Debt, Why Now is a Terrible Time to Be Young, and DIYU, Edupunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. And Anya, you wrote that this program addresses a serious problem in education known as swirling. And that's not a reference about how to make a Frappuccino. What's
That's right.
What's swirling?
Well, swirling is simply a term for the very large proportion of students these days who enroll and then re-enroll from two-year colleges to four-year colleges. Oftentimes, it's very difficult for your credits to transfer. And, you know, what they say is that life gets in the way. And that's how we came to this position where we have 37 million Americans with some college and no degree.
Some college and no degree. So what you were talking about earlier. And many large service companies offer help with tuition and have for some time. Walmart and Costco have a discounted tuition program with American Public University. UPS has a tuition reimbursement program. McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts have an online degree program. We read that Apple offers some of its employees up to $5,000 a year. Home Depot does it up to $2,500. Chick-fil-A has some scholarship programs. So why did this announcement from Starbucks make so much news?
Well, I think there's two sides of it. Obviously, Starbucks is a very high-profile corporation, and they've built an image already as being a particularly conscientious service employer, and so it fits that narrative. On the other hand, I think it's fair to look at the partner that they've chosen. Arizona State University really represents, I think, you know, for better and for worse, the most of what's going on with innovation in higher education right now.
Which means what?
Well, you know, they are very focused on student success. They're very focused on using software tools, both for their on-campus students as well as their off-campus students. They, Michael Crow, the president, has said that of 16,000 courses offered, 10,000 have some online component. You know, they have 70,000 students on the campus there.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, this is a big state university. But over the dozen or so years that the president's been there, he's been laser focused on student success. And they've attained a really high graduation rate, actually, for a university that size. It's actually 57.5%.
And
for a public university, mm-hmm. that's amazing.
And they're doing all this online stuff. They buy underwriting on this station, advertising their online their online degrees.
Well, and speaking of that, I mean, that's definitely a direction that they're expanding aggressively into. Interestingly, for, you know, people who watch New York City education, their big partner in the online programs is Pearson. And they've outsourced a lot of their functions of the online courses to Pearson's technology.
Right. And if they're okay. So we're going to go to another call. Shane in Morris County. You're on WNYC. Hi, Shane.
Hey, how
you doing?
Good. So you're a barista at Starbucks?
Yeah, actually, even though Starbucks could offer me anything, you know, free college education, anything, I would never take it as long as they continue to support the Israeli Defense Force.
Okay. I think that gets to another issue that's for a different segment. But Ariel in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ariel.
Hello, Brian. Yeah, this program they have with Starbucks feels kind of similar to what Home Depot does. I don't know if they still do it today, but when I worked for Home Depot, they told me about some type of college reimbursement plan that I actually did for only college students are actually going for degrees in either like anything that has to do with business, advertising, business administration, and they just basically just reimburse you back a certain part of the tuition. You just got to show them you have to show them your finances and show them the type of class you're taking. They just reimburse you. It doesn't matter if you're full-time or part-time.
Ariel, thank you very much. So there's another model. So what's in this for Starbucks, Anya? It's an interesting offer. It shows Howard Schultz's commitment to something, as you were describing. But is it also a way to compete for employees? Do they have trouble getting the qualified baristas that they want, and so they're offering a new benefit? Remember, that's how health insurance came to be tied to our workplaces in the United States decades ago. Does this have anything to do with competing for the workforce that they want?
You know, I think it does have to do with being an attractive employer and wanting to maintain that image for its customers as well. I mean, Starbucks was very careful about the details of this rollout. They didn't put it out quietly, and they certainly were speaking to the broader public as well that has this image of Starbucks being a socially conscious corporation.
Stephen in Highland Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I was just looking online. I haven't quite found it yet. But when I read about this yesterday, I came across a blog post saying, but wait a minute, Starbucks already had an educational benefit, and it used to be that you could go anywhere you want. And now they're requiring you that you go to Arizona State University online, which actually, to tell the truth, is kind of a subpar education, as many of these online things are. I shuddered when I hear that they're partnering with Pearson. I'm an educator myself. I'm a college educator. And I've seen Pearson. I do not trust Pearson one bit. They're for profit, not for education. And I don't know, you know, it seems like it's a reduction in benefits, not a something new. What does your caller or guest know about this?
Well, it's true that they are discontinuing their previous tuition reimbursement. However, as far as I know, that reimbursement was offered only at a local institution in Washington State, as well as Strayer, which is a for-profit. And it does seem to me, I mean, the question of quality and online is a very contested one right now. It's certainly the case that, you know, many for-profits have been questionable in their quality. Arizona State is part of a new breed of large public institutions that are getting into the online higher ed market and trading on their good name and hopefully offering something of a higher quality as well. You know, when it comes to ASU Online, we do know that they trumpet a particular statistic, which is the number of students who proceed from semester to semester, which isn't necessarily the same thing as a graduation rate, but that is extremely high. And so that's the kind of thing that they focus on and track very closely. It's 90% that, you know, finish one semester and then go on to the next. So, you know, I mean, the question, you know, the bigger question is, would this be a more generous benefit if people could attend anywhere they wanted? And obviously it would be.
And I think Ellie in Brooklyn wants to push back on the idea of online education. Hi, Ellie. You're on WNYC.
Hi. So I'm actually a student who does work about 25 hours a week. And this past semester, I got almost all A's because of the brick-and-mortarness of my college.
How do you know it's because of the brick-and-mortarness of your college?
Sorry?
How do you know it's because of the brick-and-mortarness of your college?
Well, I use this magical thing in college that professors offer, called office hours. And like, I know that I've met with my professors on many occasions, and they've really molded me into this academic or proto-academic is what I'm trying to achieve.
Right. So thank you. And, you know, you understand the concern, Anya. How are Arizona State and other online-oriented universities or universities with online programs compensating for what is lost when there isn't brick and mortarness, including professors' office hours.
Well, it's really interesting. ASU Online happens to partner with a company called InsideTrack that I've looked into a little bit, and they offer basically coaching services by phone for student success. And it's a type of thing where there's a person who has your file, and they see how you're doing in your classes, and they call you up and talk to you about any problems that you need to solve. And it's a commercialized form of something that in an idealized world, everybody would be getting face-to-face, in a small liberal arts setting. But the fact is that, working adults are choosing online education because it offers the convenience and the anywhere, anytime. And if there's a way to blend that with the online delivery with some of this human face to the services, I don't see that as a bad option for people. I mean, the problem is, obviously, if that's their only option.
Ernesto in Fairlawn works at Starbucks, I think. Hi, Ernesto.
Hi, how are you, Brian? Long-time listener. Love your show.
Thanks.
I've been working at Starbucks for 3 years, and I actually took part in their reimbursement program where you could go to any school and it would just be $500 given back to you. And I think this is a great opportunity, especially for someone who doesn't have their bachelor's and for someone working towards it, because if you're going to work, you might as well get your degree online while you're doing it.
Ernesto, thank you very much. So let's indulge for a minute on your comments in thinking about this model on a larger scale. We have employer-based health insurance, as I mentioned. Could we have employer-based higher education, and would we want to?
This is such a fascinating time because there's so many competing models out there for how we're going to provide this crucial opportunity to people. And, we had Obama last week talking about trying to make student loans more affordable. Tuition keeps increasing both in the private and the public sector, and so does debt. There's proposals on the state level, including in Tennessee earlier this year, and there's a launch and announcement today of a large organization that wants to create sort of basically scholarship programs to make public universities free. And now we have this idea, this model of employer-based higher education or tuition benefits and lowering some of the costs through online delivery. So, I think all of these things are out there. They're all symptoms of the pressure that everybody's feeling to make sure that more kids get through college.
Can you think of lessons or shortcomings from employer-based health insurance that we could apply to the higher education model? Or is that too specific a question?
No, not at all. Obviously, there's a question of people being tied to their jobs, to not having the choices. I mean, this is basically managed education in the sense that Starbucks is choosing for you what school you're going to go to. I mean, that's not really a decision that I want my coffee company to be making. People have a limited choice of undergraduate majors. Somebody pointed out that there was a young person profiled in the Times story about this, and he said he wanted to be a music major. Well, you can't really do that online. They're not an infinite number of options. And then there's a larger question of, if this really is a public good, education and healthcare are public goods, why are we leaving it up to private sector to provide that at their leisure?
One of our callers wants to know, what are the tax implications? Do you happen to know if this reimbursement for college tuition, and we're talking maybe $10,000, $11,000 even, is taxable as income? Health benefits are not, which is actually a big issue.
You'd probably have to talk to a tax attorney. I know that there's a tuition tax credit, and if you're not paying the tuition, if you get reimbursed for the tuition, it would certainly affect your ability to claim that tax credit. But by and large, I don't know if it can be considered taxable income.
All right. You will have to work that out for yourself, baristas, or just ask your supervisor because they probably know. But we will have to leave it there on your comments. These days on NPR's education team, and she's also the author of Generation Debt, Why Now is a Terrible Time to Be Young, and DIYU, Edupunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education. Anya, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, stay with us. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.